Hello and welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Garner, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to begin with Earl Stanley Garner's Case of the Careless Kitten. And what we learned in the last chapter was that Mason was sitting quietly during the hearing of Della Street. Berger tried to show the jury how guilty Della was, but was interrupted by Perry Mason, who asked for a 30-minute recess. And now we begin Chapter 23. As soon as the court had adjourned and the judge had left the bench, Hamilton Berger came pushing his way across to Mason. "Mason, what the devil does this mean?" Mason smiled affably. "I'm sure I couldn't say, Berger. All I'm doing is defending Miss Street against a criminal charge. I don't think the jury will convict her." "Do you?" Berger said. "To hell with that. We all have a duty to perform, apprehending a murderer. Did Franklin Shore do it?" "I'm sure I couldn't tell you." Lunk came through the rail, which separated the council tables from the spectators. "I want to talk with the district attorney." "What is it?" Berger asked. Lunk said, "Franklin Shore may have put that gun in the flower, but I don't think he did it. And I know darn well he didn't put the money in there." "Well, how do you know?" Mason asked. "Because Shore was trying to get me to give him some money," Lunk said. "You didn't do it?" "No." "Well, why?" Mason asked. "Because I wanted him to stay where he was until I had a chance to talk with Mrs. Shore." "And why was he so anxious to get money and get away?" Mason asked. "Come on, Lunk. You told me that you might let me know what it was Shore really told you. Now you've done a lot of covering up. Suppose you come clean now, Lunk." "I reckon I better," Lunk said. "Shore came to the house. He was nervous. He said that he'd had some trouble with a man and had shot him. He said he had to get away quick, that he had to shoot to keep the other guy from shooting him, but he was afraid the police might think it was murder. He said Matilda wouldn't like anything better than to get him in the spot. I told him I thought he'd better talk with her anyway before he left, and he didn't want to, so I told him that he could hide at my place, but as soon as I could get in touch with Mrs. Shore the next morning, I'd try to get an advance on my salary and give him a stake so he could get out. And I told him that, and he went to bed and to sleep. That's when I went to see Mrs. Shore. I wanted to tell her what I had seen her husband doing, and I wanted to see whether she wanted to stake him or whether she didn't. If she hadn't," Mason asked, "would you have surrendered Shore to the police?" "I don't know, Mr. Mason. Shore had me pretty square, understand. I didn't intend to tell Mrs. Shore that he was staying at my house. I was going to tell her that I'd seen him. I was trying to give them both a square deal." Mason said, "Go ahead, Lunk. Tell the district attorney the whole truth. You've got to do it now. Tell him what Shore told you about where he'd been."
We didn't
talk much, at least as long as it took him to smoke a cigar," Mason said. "Tell Mr. Berger what he said." Lunk hesitated, then blurted, "Well, he ran away with that woman." "Where and why?" Mason asked. "It was like I told you," Lunk said. "When Franklin Shore was down in Florida, people began to mistake him for another man. Shore looked this man up. They might have been twins. So they had a joke, and they had their pictures taken. And Shore started joshing his wife that he was going to tell this man all about people he knew and have the guy be at the bridge party at his stooge. Then Shore fell in love with this younger woman, so he got the idea that if maybe he could disappear, take this dame with him, and go to Florida and start training the other guy to be his double, telling him all about the business affairs and the people he was dealing with. Then, after 6 months, when this man had everything all down pat, he would show up and claim he was Shore. He'd say his mind had suddenly gone blank, and even after his memory got back, he was still a little shaky. Well, Shore did it. Things went fine. Instead of 6 months, his double was all ready. So Shore sent a postal card to his niece from Miami.
He figured police would come and find the double, apparently still in a sort of daze, but claiming to be sure. And his memory would come back a little at a time. Of course, he'd be too sick to be very active in business, but he'd draw plenty of dough from his investments, and he'd send the real Shore a cut out of it. And Franklin Shore would take the other guy's name and marry the dame, and it would be okay. Then the night Franklin Shore sent the postal, this guy was killed in an auto accident. Well, there was Shore with his bridges all burned up, holding the sack. How about Leach? Mason asked. Leach had got the boss sold on his mine. So the boss had given Leach some dough and cash to put in the mine, saying it wasn't from him, but from a guy in Florida. And Leach, thinking the Florida guy was a sucker, froze him out when he struck it rich. Of course, the boss was the real Florida guy. He'd just given Leach a phony name. Lately, Shore got to needing money. He went to Leach. Leach was to give him the dough, but he was stony broke by this time, so Shore had to come back. The dame left him a couple of years ago, and Shore was flat broke. And that's everything I know about it. That's the whole story, the way the boss gave it to me there in the shack. Hamilton Berger said, "The thing's incredible. That's the damnedest story I've ever heard." Lunk said in a flat, emotionless voice of a man who isn't trying to convince anyone, "It sounded all right to me." Maybe hearing it from the boss's own lips made it seem more convincing. But that's the story he told me. Mason said to the district attorney, "Suppose it's all true, up to the point where the auto accident took place, Berger. Then suppose it was Shore who was killed. This double has been training to take Shore's place. He knew intimate things that Shore had told him and had written them down and memorized them. A fortune was waiting for him if he could impersonate Franklin Shore and make it stick." "Then why didn't he show up sooner?" Berger asked. "One possible explanation is that Mrs. Shore knew about this double her husband had dug up," Mason replied. "Remember, Shore had stated it was a joke, and his wife knew all about it. But if Mrs. Shore should die, then the double could show up as the missing husband and claim the whole estate." Berger gave a low whistle and then said, "Damn. And that would explain the poison." Mason lit a cigarette. Lunk said, "This wasn't no double that came to my house. It was a boss." "Well, how do you know?" Mason asked. "Because he told me some things that only the boss knew." Mason smiled at Hamilton Berger. Lunk frowned, then suddenly, "Well, no matter who this was, he was broke. Why should he steal the few hundred I kept hidden in my clothes and then leave a fortune in my flour?" Berger looked at Mason for an answer. "No comment," Mason said, smiling. "Do you think the man who called on Lunk was the double or Shore himself?" Berger asked Mason. Mason said, "I don't know, Berger. I didn't see him. After all, you know, you've said you'd prefer I mind my own business, and I let the police solve the murders. Suppose you wrestle with that problem." "Damn it, it could have been either one," Berger exclaimed. Mason seemed completely disinterested. "Well, I think my clients are in the clear, both Della Street and Gerald Shore." Hamilton's Berger showed expression. "This is the damnedest case." Mason stretched and yawned. "I don't find it so," he said. "However, I'm not interested in anything except getting Miss Street acquitted." "What the devil is that business about the cat psychology you're talking about? And what does it have to do with the case?" Berger said. Mason said, "I'm afraid if I told you, Berger, you'd accuse me of trying to outwit the police. I've been thinking over what you said to me there in your office. I think there's a great deal to be said in favor of your position. You think an attorney has no business going out trying to solve murders, that he should confine himself to handling his own law practice, and I'm forced to agree with you. I'm representing Gerald Shore, and I'm representing Della Street, and I have no interest in solving murders as such. But you want to get Gerald Shore and Charlie out of the clear, don't you?" "Yes. There's no better way to do it than by showing us who committed the murders." "No," Mason said, "that isn't the law. It's what you were objecting to about my methods. Berger, you see, it's up to you to prove that my clients committed some crime, As long as I confine myself to representing those clients, I'm practicing law in a staid, conventional manner. The minute I go out and try to outwit the police, as you called it, I'm guilty of that unconventional conduct, which has proven so irritating to you. Well, in fact, Mr. District Attorney, I've decided to let you solve your own mysteries, and that's the last word I was telling you I was going to have. Come on, Della, let's have Lieutenant Trag and the district attorney to work out their little picture puzzle. After all, it's no skin off our noses. Berger said, look here, Mason. You can't do that. I'm satisfied you know a lot more about this case than we do.
No, I don't, Mason said. You have every essential fact that I have.
Well, perhaps you've applied the knowledge we all have to better advantage.
Mason bowed. Well, thank you, Counselor. All right, you owe it to us to tell us what conclusions you've reached.
Mason said, I'll tell you what I'll do, Berger. I'll put you on my equal footing with me. There's one thing I know that you don't. Lunk told me that he was satisfied Como, the houseboy, had been experimenting with poison, that he'd first started experimenting about 10 years ago, that shortly before Franklin Shore's disappearance, Lunk's brother died, and Lunk also had been under the impression the houseboy poisoned him.
Is that right? Berger asked Lunk.
Lunk turned and said, that's right. I don't think that damn Jap had anything against my brother in particular, but I think he was experimenting with the poison, and just the way he started experimenting on that kitten.
Lieutenant Trag, who had just come up to join the group, said, there were 4 bottles of stout in the icebox. Every one of them had been loaded with strychnine. Do you think the houseboy did that?
I know damn well he did it, Lunk said vehemently.
How do you know? Well, just from putting 2 and 2 together, the same as you know anything,
Berger said to Trag. There's some new and startling evidence here, Lieutenant, and I want to talk with you.
Mason smiled and said, what Lunk means, Lieutenant, is that he feels very positively Como is the poisoner.
You'll remember, Lieutenant, that you told me you thought the evidence would show the bullets had been all fired from the same gun, and that would mean that one person had been guilty of both crimes. Now, following that reasoning, Matilda Shore has a perfect alibi. She was in the hospital when the second crime was committed. Gerald Shore has an alibi. You probably know what it is, but I'm not going to stick my neck out by telling you that because I don't know and I don't want to be a witness. And you can eliminate Helen Kendall and Jerry Templar. You can eliminate darn near everyone, that theory, except 3 or 4 people. There you are, Lieutenant. Pay your money and take your choice. But if I were you, I really would investigate the death of Lunk's brother and see if it isn't possible that the death was due to poison rather than natural causes. And now, if you gentlemen will excuse me, I have a dinner date with the defendant.
Chapter 24. The dance orchestra was perfect. The lights were dim on the floor. Only a few couples were dancing, so that they were neither crowded nor conspicuous. Without either having spoken for a long time, Perry Mason and Della Street were drifting through the strains of an island song. The orchestra swung into chorus. Della Street began to sing the words very softly. Suddenly she stopped with an involuntary choke.
Smatter, swallow a fly, he demanded. Go on, do some more. I like it.
She shook her head. Something wrong? He asked more seriously.
No, I guess not. I've eaten, I've drunken, I've been merry, so I guess I'm all set for tomorrow.
The music stopped at that moment. Mesa, with his arm still around her waist, swung her away so that he could look at her. His eyes were puzzled for an instant. Then they cleared.
I didn't get you, I see. Tomorrow you die? Have you been worrying about that damn silly case?
She laughed nervously. I suppose every nice girl has to go through this sort of thing sooner or later.
But you haven't committed any crime.
I wish you'd remember to tell Hamilton Berger when you see him. It seems ridiculous not to clear up this little misunderstanding when all you have to do is say, listen, Ham, old fella, this little girl is, oh, hell's bells, let's sit down.
Perry followed her to the table. I thought you were worried, Della went on, when you brought the kitten out to me and found that Franklin Shore wasn't there.
I was, Mason admitted. If I'd used my head, though, I needn't have been.
I don't get it, she said, lighting a cigarette.
You should. If you knew kittens, you mean the kitten jumping in the flower?
No, not that.
Well, what is it then? He asked, noticing that she was staring over her shoulder.
Paul Drake.
How did he find us here? Mason asked, frowning. Drake was close enough to hear Mason's remark. He pulled out a chair and sat down.
As you well know, I can find anybody, anytime, any place. Here's my card. Aren't you going to order me a drink?
Cops and private dicks should drink when they're on duty. No, never should they do that.
Paul Drake, the fellow I work for, is broad-minded. He's a swell guy. He's a prince. You ought to meet him.
Mason summoned a waiter.
3 scotch and sodas.
5 scotches, Drake corrected. But only 3 of them in my glass. I never could stand strong highballs.
The waiter hesitated, then deftly withdrew.
You know, Perry, I didn't just drop in here to buy you and Della scotch and soda. There's something worrying me.
Have you been arrested, too? Della cried.
Paul Drake ignored her comment to look steadily at the lawyer.
Perry, he said, you weren't by any chance planning something special, something dramatic, a blow-off for tomorrow, were you, using your friend Tom Lunk?
Perhaps. Why?
You're not going to do it now, Drake said.
Well, why not?
Lunk's dead. Found at the road intersection a couple of blocks from his house, a hit-and-run car. A witness saw it happen and chased after the car for a half a dozen blocks, but couldn't even get close enough to see the license number. The car swung around to the corner just after Lunk got off the street car he rides home on.
Mason drummed on the tablecloth with his fingers. Berger was a damn fool to release him, he said. Apparently he thought Lunk had told him everything he knew and there was no reason for holding him any longer.
Mason frowned. What were you intending to spring on Lunk? Della asked.
Quite a few things. Has it ever seemed curious to you, Della, that after I've taken all the precautions to get Lunk registered in a hotel under the name of Thomas Trimmer, the police should have picked him up so easily?
Someone must have followed you, Drake said.
Mason shook his head. Don't kid yourself, Paul. When I don't want to be followed, no one follows me.
Then who tipped them off? It couldn't have been the hotel clerk.
No. And you can follow the process of elimination right on through. There's only one person who could have done it.
Who?
Lunk.
Drake looked incredulous. You mean that he telephoned the police himself?
Yes.
But that was a goofy, crazy thing to do. Why would he do anything like that?
Mason said, the fact gives you the key to the whole business.
But why? Della asked.
Mason said, there's only one reason I can think of.
What's that?
He wanted to be arrested, Mason said dryly.
You mean that he felt he was in danger?
Mason shrugged his shoulders. The waiter brought the drinks. Drake raised his glass to Della.
Here's to jail, he grinned.
Well, Perry, what do we do now?
Or I should say, what do you do now?
Mason said nothing, absolutely nothing. Hamilton Berger is going to have to crack this nut by himself. That jury will never convict Della, not as long as there are 2 women on it who know something about cats.
Della Street put her glass down firmly. If you don't explain what you mean by that, I will be convicted of a crime, and it will be murder.
No prosecutor in this state would charge you with murder for killing Perry Mason, Drake pointed out.
You'd get a reward. But what did the kitten do that's so significant?
Mason grinned. It was a cold night. The kitten jumped into the flower when someone was hiding the gun in the can. Naturally, the kitten got thrown out, probably with a cuff on the ear. Now that kitten had a lot of kind treatment and didn't like the rough stuff. It ran out of the kitchen and into the back bedroom and jumped onto the bed. It didn't stay there, though. It jumped off the bed and went to the other bed.
Well, why? Drake asked.
Della Street gave a sudden quick gasp. Oh, she cried, I know why. Anyone, if he stopped to think about it, would.
Drake shook his head and got up.
Where are you going, Paul? Della demanded.
I'm going out to buy a cat so I can study him and learn about some of the important facts of life.
You would at that, you know, Mason told him seriously.
Good night,
Drake muttered lugubriously.
With Paul Drake gone, Mason turned to Della. You know, Della, this has been more of a strain on you than I realized. As soon as that jury brings in the verdict tomorrow, what you do say, we take a run out to the desert around Palm Springs or Indio. We'll do some horseback riding, lie in the sun. Perry, I may be convicted tomorrow, Mason grinned. You forget those two women on the jury who know cats. Aren't you going to explain any more to the jury? Not a bit. Why? Because if I did, I'd be explaining to Hamilton Berger. I'm going to let him fry in his own grease. What will Lieutenant Tragg do? Eventually, Mason said, Lieutenant Tragg will solve the case, but won't it take the jury a long while to get the whole idea through its head? Mason said, now that's something that would be a sporting bet. I'll bet you $5 that jury will be out for at least 3 hours. It'll come in with a verdict of not guilty, but it'll be dazed as a sort of jury with two triumphant women smiling at you and the men scowling. Then we'll start out for the desert, and Hamilton Berger will start talking with the jurors, trying to find out what it was about the kitten that broke the case. Then he'll try to get in touch with me, and we'll be out in the desert somewhere. Let's forget it, and let's dance. Next week, we'll read Chapter 25, In the Case of the Careless Kitten, by Earl Stanley Gardner. Our next reading comes from the magazine ASPCA Action. It is issue 2, 2026. Dina started a new chapter at the Recovery and Rehabilitation Center. After saying goodbye to their 14-year-old dachshund, Kippy, last October, Barry Lynn R. asked her family, how can we live without a dog? There were no more daily walks, Barry Lynn said. She had adopted Kippy from a New Jersey shelter 10 years earlier and said, I had no reason to go anywhere. In January, Barry Lynn's daughter, Suri, a volunteer at the ASPCA Adoption Center, suggested she meet Dina, a young dog she regularly walked. Rescue and refeeding. On October 23, 2025, at an NYPD lieutenant found a young dog tied to a tree in the Queens Park. He took her to the emergency clinic, and the next day she was transported to the ASPCA, where staff estimated she was a Labrador Retriever mix. Weighing just 26 pounds, Dina was weak from muscle loss and placed on a refeeding diet to safely transition from survival metabolism, using her own body tissue for nutrition, to a normal metabolism. Over 8 weeks, Dina gained 10 pounds, a 38% increase. Road to recovery. On November 13th, Dina moved to the ASPCA's Recovery and Rehabilitation Center in Pawling, New York. There she recovered in a calmer environment, better suited to her needs. Spayed and returned to the adoption center on January 6th, she was adopted by Barry Lynn 12 days later. Now a 50-pound dog, Dina is much happier and more filled out. Barry Lynn is happier, too. As soon as I had Dina, I was walking and meeting people again, she says. She is proof that there are some really great dogs at shelters and at rescues. This article, Dina started a new chapter at the Recovery and Rehabilitation Center. Putting relationships first in equine adoption. Adopting a horse is a big decision, one that works best when trust and understanding come first. Through a conversational approach to adoption, replacing paperwork heavy forms with personalized one-on-one conversations, our team helps horses and people find not just homes, but lasting partnerships. After completing a short open-ended adoption inquiry form, adoptions are invited to a phone or video call where they're asked their experience, goals, and hopes for their next equine partner. Many adopters worry about saying the wrong thing or not being good enough, but through these real conversations, anxiety softens into confidence, questions lead to understanding, trust builds, and the result is a calmer adopter, better matched horses, and relationships that continue long after adoption day. Through the years, it has been a joy to witness how conversations with adopters change for the better when they are not put on the defensive and can relax into a discussion that is friendly and curious, says Libby Hannon, marketing and adoptions manager at the ASPCA Equine Transition and Adoption Center. She has seen it time and again. A hesitant adopter relaxes, a connection clicks, and weeks later, photos arrive showing a horse thriving in a new life. Those updates aren't just heartwarming, they're signs of success. This approach takes patience, training, and dedicated staff. It means listening closely, staying concerned, and supporting adopters through the challenges, big and small. With your support, horses aren't rushed into placement. They're matched carefully, supported fully, and welcomed into the new home built to last. These articles came from the ASPCA Action Magazine, the official magazine of the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Issue 2, 2026. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of Animal Companions for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the readings, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.